In a time of deep conflict and divide across the world, what does it mean to be Jewish in America today?
Jews are a very big, very loving, and pretty dysfunctional family. Family is where we have our first experiences of true love, and they're often also the place where we have our first experiences of true struggle.
One scholar and Jew says now is the time for a new look at the heart of the Jewish identity. I'm Nyla Boodoo, and from Axios, this is One Big Thing. It's been more than 9 months since the October 7th Hamas terrorist attack, in which Israel says 1,200 Israelis and foreigners were killed, and another 253 taken hostage. With Israel's ensuing war in Gaza, the Palestinian Health Authority estimates 38,000 Palestinians, many women and children, have been killed. And all of this has made many Jews around the world consider the core of their faith and the role of Israel. That's been especially visible when we've seen protests around the war, with Jewish voices on both sides. Harvard legal and religious scholar Noah Feldman has been thinking more about his own faith in the last year, especially as he watches political and intergenerational conflict play out around him.
What I'm seeing on campus, I think what a lot of us are seeing on campus, is that young progressive Jews are saying, you know what, we're not on board with supporting Israel. And the Gen X and, you know, even some of the millennial Jews are saying, what are you guys talking about? You know, you're our kids or our siblings, and we taught you to be committed to Israel. And they're saying, well, no, what you taught us was to believe that Judaism is committed to the values of social justice. And that's what we take seriously. And if we think Israel is incompatible with that, we are going to criticize Israel sometimes very severely. So there's a kind of intergenerational tension. It's within families, but you see it very clearly on university campuses.
With this tension in mind, Noah wrote a new book called To Be a Jew Today, A New Guide to God, Israel, and the Jewish People. So I invited Noah to talk to me for the first of a few conversations I'll be having on this pod about faith in America today and how changing religious identities affect us all. So you told me you first wanted to call this book Bad Jews. Can you tell me why?
Yeah, I always hear Jewish friends of mine saying, usually about themselves, and usually kind of in a rueful manner, oh, I'm such a bad Jew. You know, oh, I'm not going home for Passover this year. I'm such a bad Jew. You know, oh, I had a cheeseburger for lunch on Yom Kippur. I'm such a bad Jew. And I wanted to say to them, you're not bad Jews. You know, I mean, you're actually doing the thing you're supposed to be doing, which is thinking about your conduct, thinking about the world, thinking about what it means to be Jewish, and you're being a little bit ironic and playful around it, and that's a good thing. And then I wanted to make the argument that we actually do really badly as a world and as a Jewish community when we call other people bad Jews. And unfortunately, Jews have a tendency to do that. Judge not lest ye be judged, which is something that Jesus said. He was Jewish when he said it, but it's not for nothing that that became a crucial teaching of Christianity, but not so much of Judaism. So that's why I wanted to write the book, and that was going to be my title, but then the events of October 7 intervened, and very hard to be lighthearted right now around being Jewish. So I decided to grow up and be serious. And there you have the serious title.
Let's go back a little bit, because I often think when we're talking about faith traditions, how someone was raised plays such an important role in shaping one's belief system as an adult. So what was your upbringing like?
My upbringing was quirky, I would say, from a Jewish perspective. My parents were both university teachers, and I grew up in Cambridge, Massachusetts, which is still where I live, which is not a normal place by any stretch of the imagination. And they also, though, their rebellion of the 1960s is that they became Orthodox Jews. They didn't become ultra-Orthodox Jews, so they didn't wear different clothes than everybody else, but they strictly kept the Sabbath, and they strictly kept the kosher laws, and they still do, as a matter of fact. And so that was a crucial part of my upbringing. We went to synagogue. We walked to synagogue a couple of miles in each way every Saturday. And I went to an Orthodox Jewish school from first grade through 12th grade. So that was my upbringing. And the particular community I grew up in, the modern Orthodox community, likes to think of itself as having the best of both worlds. On the one hand, they're deeply committed to following the tradition and the rules. And on the other hand, they see themselves as modern, as open to ideas. You don't have to, you know, believe that the earth was created 5,700 years ago. You know, you don't have to believe every detail of what an ultra-Orthodox Jew might believe. You can be a modern person, but still be fully on board with traditional Judaism. That's their worldview.
How would you characterize your faith and your Judaism now?
You know, in this book, I write a lot about the different perspectives that different people have on their Jewishness. Everything from what I call, in a positive sense, bagels and lox Jews, for whom it's cultural identification, all the way through progressive Jews, for whom Judaism is social justice, evolutionist Jews, sort of like the modern Orthodox Jews I was describing, who believe that you can evolve the tradition in a good way, and then the traditionalists or ultra-Orthodox, who believe that there are rules, God gave them on Mount Sinai, there's a specific set of rabbis and they're in charge of interpreting them and your job is to follow those rules. I've kind of, at different points in my life, held some version of all of those points of view. I've sort of circled through all of them, including lots of periods of my life when I would have said, if you asked me, do you believe in God? I would have said, of course not. Couldn't possibly. Where I am now is, I would say, I'm very, very moved by and invested in all of the do's in the tradition, all of the holidays, the kinds of learning, both spiritual and mystical and intellectual, associated with Jewishness. I teach a bunch of classes on Judaism. Those things matter a ton to me. And I'm less focused in my own life on all the don'ts that the tradition has. I mean, to be clear, I try to avoid the don'ts that are, you know, universal moral precepts. You know, I try not to lie and cheat and steal and so forth. But I don't think of not doing those things primarily because the Bible said not to, rather because they're part of a good life.
You do wrestle in your book with the idea that you can be Jewish and not necessarily believe in God. Why do you think it's important that contemporary descriptions of Judaism today include that?
So many Jews agree that you can be Jewish without believing in God, that it's almost created a background expectation that talking about God at all is sort of awkward or embarrassing. You know, I mean, if you ask a friend of yours who's an evangelical Christian to describe their faith, they will begin by talking about their personal relationship with God. And I find it incredibly moving to hear people talk about that, because that's clearly why they are evangelical Christians, because of their faith and this relationship. If you ask Jews, why are you Jewish, or why are you the kind of Jewish you are, almost none of them will even mention God. And for some of them, that's not right. For some of them, God really does matter and really is significant. For others, they're agnostic or even atheist, but that's a relationship with God too. You know, if you're not sure that God is there, that's a relationship with God. And so I think, since I'm trying to answer in the book the question, why be a Jew? Why bother to be a Jew? It kind of hamstrings that whole conversation. If you don't accept as one of the possible answers, it makes me feel a certain way in relationship to the universe. It makes me feel a certain way in relationship to the spiritual. It makes me feel a certain way in relationship to the divine. I know a lot of people who are Jewish who are deeply enmeshed in other religious and spiritual traditions. They're deeply interested in Hinduism. They're deeply interested in Buddhism. They meditate. They do yoga. Some are interested in New Age spiritualities as well. And I think for a lot of those people, the reasons they found themselves there is they were looking for something genuinely spiritual and meaningful, but they didn't find it in the Judaism they grew up with. And the reason for that is that Judaism forgot to mention that Jews have all this stuff, you know, that lots of Jews do now and have always believed in angels, do now and have always believed in magic, do now and have always believed in mystical experience. And so there's a worry that the Judaism will lose a whole generation of people if they think that the only traditions that are open to altered consciousness and mystical experience are other faith traditions.
I do think this might be confusing from people from other faith traditions to think, why should we consider the godless Jewish person part of this discussion? Why do you think that that's important?
Yeah, thanks for asking that. You know, Jewishness is an ethnicity and a faith tradition all at the same time. The way I think of Jews is Jews are a very big, very loving, and pretty dysfunctional family. And that's
no different than any family, in other words.
Exactly. Much like most other families in the world. In fact, you know, I even say in the book that the core of Jewishness is to be loving and struggling with one another and with the divine at the same time. And that's what it's like in our families. Family is where we have our first experiences of true love. And they're often also the place where we have our first experiences of true struggle. So if Jewishness is like a family, sometimes in the family, you share a lot of beliefs, and that's what holds you together. But sometimes you don't share beliefs. You know, you have very different or opposed views even from what your parents or your siblings or your cousins or other family members have. But you're still connected. You're still family. And so for Jews who just flat out don't believe in God, they're still fully part of the family. And so in that sense, they're fully Jewish. And what's more, godless Jews care a lot about what other Jews do and what other Jews think. They almost never just walk away entirely and say, I'd rather think I was never Jewish at all. And I will add, if someone wants to do that, that's also fine with me. You know, I mean, family is the same. We ideally love our families and try to connect to them. Sometimes we need space from our families. And there's some families where you just say, you know, I don't want any part of my family of origin. I'm going to go off and I'm going to find some other healthier and better family. And it's fine from my perspective if some Jews feel that way too. You know, I think by calling my book To Be a Jew Today, I'm also incorporating the possibility of not to be a Jew today. To be implies that you have the option of not being. And that's fine with me if people want to do that. I just want to make sure they know the family is there and that it has a lot to offer them if they want it.
So I think the background of all of this is Israel. And you wrote in your book, Israel did not end Jewish history, but Israel is becoming the defining component of Jewishness itself. How do you think that has happened?
A lot of Jews today feel very strongly about Israel. For many, many Jews, that strength of feeling is fellow feeling, familial connection, support of Israel, love of Israel. And for other Jews, that feeling is pretty negative. It's criticism of Israel or the commitment to the idea that Israel needs to change and do a lot better. But it wasn't always that way. You know, I mean, Israel's only been around for 75 years, and Judaism has been around, depending on how you count, for somewhere between 2,000 and 3,000 years. So Israel came out of a very specific nationalist movement called Zionism, which said, let's make a country, and let's have the identity of that country replace the identity of being Jewish. And that's the part that never happened. You know, Jews didn't stop being Jews just because there was a state of Israel. But what did happen is that nationalism is such a powerful force. And we can see this everywhere in the world today. You know, you can see it everywhere from, I don't know, from India to Poland. Nationalism remains, even 200 and something years after nationalism was invented, one of the most powerful pulls on people's beliefs and identities. I would add China to that too. And that happened for Jews as well. Nationalism became a driving force. And then for a lot of Jews, it began to kind of fill in the as an answer to the question, why be Jewish? And especially if you're a modern person and the answer to why be Jewish for you isn't because I belong to a covenant that is connected to the divine, then a possible answer that sounds more secular is, well, I'm part of this community and we have national solidarity and we support this, you know, this team, this cause, this country. And so I think that's how it's happened, that for many Jews, Israel is the main component of their Jewishness. It's usually not the only one. It usually would go alongside something else, like commemoration of the Holocaust, perhaps. Social justice values are a really important component of Jewishness for many, many progressive American Jews. But almost no matter where you fall on the Jewish spectrum, you have some strong feelings about Israel. And October 7 really showed that. For some people, it meant they wanted to really criticize Israel. For others, they wanted to really support Israel more than they had done before. But relatively few Jews post-October 7 have thought, you know what, I'm just not going to think about Israel one way or the other. It's just not important to me at all.
Okay, so we need to take a short break. More on being a Jew today when we come back. This is One Big Thing from Axios.
Every day, Axios helps millions of smart professionals get smarter faster with our daily essential newsletters, Axios AM, Axios PM, and Axios Finish Line. Helmed by veteran journalist Mike Allen, these three newsletters keep you up to speed, day and night, about what's happening worldwide and why it matters. Subscribe today at axios.com/newsletters.
Welcome back to One Big Thing from Axios. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Over the coming weeks on the pod, we'll be exploring how religious identity is shifting in the face of political forces. And I've been bringing you my conversation with Harvard's Noah Feldman, whose new book explores the heart of the Jewish identity today. Right now, I think so much of the conversation around Judaism in the U.S. is around anti-Semitism. How do you think redefining Judaism today could help tackle that, or does it?
So I take anti-Semitism seriously, and there's a very subtle question of when anti-Israel sentiment can veer into becoming anti-Semitic, because it's, of course, totally legit to criticize Israel on a whole bunch of grounds. That's not inherently anti-Semitic. But there are also some criticisms of Israel that do start to become anti-Semitism, at least in my view. So that has to be taken very, very seriously. At the same time, what I'm interested in doing, especially in this book, is asking, why do you want to be a Jew? And is the reason really that there's anti-Semitism out there? To me, that seems like a terrible reason to be a Jew. I don't think it's ethically appealing, morally appealing, aesthetically appealing, religiously appealing to think that the reason I am something is that somebody hates that thing. I want my own independent reasons that have nothing to do with anti-Semites to explain why I have a Passover Seder or why I try to put down my technology from Friday night to Saturday night. And I think those reasons need to come from within. And they need to come from your sense, if you choose this approach, of how you want to make sense out of your own life and what emotions and thoughts you have around the big questions. You know, why are we here? What's our purpose? And it happens that the Jewish tradition has some very rich answers to those questions. And it also gives you a lot of room to argue about it. So if you're the kind of person who hates arguing about the important things, Judaism may not actually be for you. You know, Judaism is great for people who recognize that love and struggle come together in the real world. It's great for people who like to discuss and disagree. It's great for people who like to reconsider their core ideas. And it's great for people who aren't put off by that. As a marketing strategy, that's not a very good marketing strategy for a religion. You know, I mean, just about any other world religion is bigger than Judaism. And the reason for that is most other world religions think the goal is not to struggle, but to be at peace. You could really achieve some state of non-attachment to a Buddhist, and then you would be at peace. Or you could accept Christ's love and you could really be at peace. Or you could accept God's authority and you could really be a good Muslim. All of these are much more appealing options than a religion that says, yeah, it's going to be a struggle. You know, we love each other. We love God. God loves us. We love the other. And we're all going to struggle about that all the time. So not a good marketing strategy. But for the people for whom that resonates, I think it can offer a lot of value and meaning. And that's so much more attractive to me than the idea that, well, someone out there hates me, so therefore I'm going to keep on doing what I'm doing.
You use the story of Jacob and Esau to end your book, to ask if there's a way for all of these competing interests, everything we've talked about, to really work. Do you think there is?
I think there is a way to make it better than it might otherwise be. There's a famous story in the Bible of Jacob staying up all night wrestling with a being who might be an angel or a man or a god, at the end of which that being blesses Jacob and gives him the name Israel, which means to struggle with God. But people tend to forget that just a few verses later in the story, Jacob actually meets someone else he's not seen in a long time, and that's his brother Esau, whom he hasn't seen in more than 20 years. And he's convinced that Esau is going to try to kill him because of the way that he took advantage of Esau the last time they saw each other. And instead, Esau hugs him, and when Jacob offers him a huge gift, which is basically a bribe, Esau says, I have plenty. You keep what's yours. And then they hug each other and they fall on each other's shoulders and they cry. And to me, that captures the dimension of love that comes alongside the dimension of struggle. They really love each other. And poetically, wrestling and hugging are very closely related. And in Hebrew, fascinatingly, those words are separated by just one letter. I'm sure that's not a coincidence. So anyone who ever has had a family knows that just because you love your siblings or other people doesn't mean you're not mad at them. In fact, sometimes you can be madder at your family than at anybody else. But there's something different about the way you're mad at your family. And there's something different about the kind of love that you can feel alongside people with whom you share so much. And for me, that's a good metaphor, certainly for what Jews can do for each other, but also maybe, to say more ambitiously, for what all of us can do as human beings when we really disagree with people, when we really think they're wrong. We can remember that we're all coming from a place of a common humanity, and it's not going to make us agree. So this isn't a picture where we all get along. We don't. That's not what life is like. It's not what families are like. It's not what the world is like. But it might be a world where when we disagree, we do so with the recognition of the fact that we're all trying our best. We're all trying our hardest to get it right.
Noah Feldman is the author of To Be a Jew Today, A New Guide to God, Israel, and the Jewish People. Thanks, Noah.
Thank you for having me again.
And that does it for this week's edition of One Big Thing. As always, we'd love to hear from you, especially if this conversation has sparked thoughts in you about your own faith or lack thereof. Record a voice memo and you can send it to us at 202-918-4893, and we'll include it in upcoming episodes. The One Big Thing team includes supervising producer Alexandra Boti and sound engineer Jake Howitt, who also composed and produced our music along with Alex Sugiyara. Sarah Kehlani Gu is executive editor of Axios Live, and Asia Whitaker Moore is Axios's editor-in-chief. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, and we'll see you back here next Thursday.
The Smart Brevity Studio at Axios helps advertisers communicate in Axios' signature Smart Brevity style. Our team of creative experts, trained just like our newsroom, work with brands to craft their stories in a way that will effectively earn our readers' attention. Reach smart, influential professionals across various industries such as technology, government, healthcare, and more with Axios. Get in touch at axios.com/advertise.